great to have the choir as a group this morning. Wonderful job. We love all of the offerings that we get, especially during the summer. But it's nice when we've had some of those solos and special small groups to hear all of you in full voice together as well. This morning, as we continue on our Finding Faith Off the Beaten Path series that we're doing this summer, I wanted to share with you one of my favorite songs. It's not by a worship band, but I do find it incredibly worshipful. And I often connect with God through it, especially when some of those cultural and social controversies and toxicity that we referenced a little bit in last week's sermon are coming up for us especially strongly. I'll start by reading the lyrics of the verses to you, and maybe you can see why this has some of that meaning to you. And I do have some extra slides this time. Thanks, Jay. First verse goes, "God, little soul, the world is a cold, cold place to be. Want a little warmth, but who's going to save a little warmth for me?" Goes on in the second verse, "If I'm born again, I know that the world will disagree. Want a little grace, but who's going to say a little grace for me?" And then the final verse says, "See the sun go down, it's going on down, and the night is deep. Want a little light, but who's going to save a little light for me?" Out of curiosity, does anyone recognize that song? Does anybody know that? That's okay, that's good. You'll get to learn about it. Oh, I don't know about that. That's true. I guess the melody could help. But you may be thinking, all right, Rob, yeah, I can hear that the song has some nice spiritual imagery and that there's a feeling of things not being great in the world. And so the person is kind of reaching out to God about those circumstances. That doesn't seem like that big a deal. What's the point? Where's the off-the-beaten-path for what you just shared? Well, if you don't recognize the song, as I said, it's not by a worship band or a specifically Christian artist. It's by a band called Vampire Weekend. So that's kind of a weird name for a band to begin with. And the song is called Unbelievers. And so I'll read you the chorus now, and that it's repeated after each verse, and you'll hear where that title comes from. The chorus starts, "We know the fire awaits unbelievers, all of the sinners the same. Girl, you and I will die, unbelievers, bound to the tracks of the train. I'm not excited, but should I be? Is this the fate that half of the world has planned for me? I know I love you, and you love the sea, but what holy water contains a little drop for me." So now maybe it makes a little bit more sense. In this song with spiritual yearning, the singer says that he will be a part of unbelievers. So now we might ask ourselves more bluntly, why would a Christian find this song, this unbeliever song, worshipful? Does anyone here, I'm going to take a quick pivot, but we'll circle back. Does anyone here have a favorite fact about Christian history that really surprised you when you learned it? Promise it'll come back. Does anyone have something, you learned something about history you hadn't learned before, and you're like, huh, that really makes me see God or my faith a little bit differently? And I'm putting you on the spot. That's okay. Yes? Healing of the lepers. Yeah, that's a really good story that way. And there's the one that where having them come back and having the one come back and be thankful when others hadn't. A lot of people have learned from that. And then another one of the stories of Jesus healing lepers is one of my favorites because it tells of Jesus specifically touching the leper when everyone else in that society would have said, well, I don't even want to come close to you. But Jesus sort of showing, my holiness, my healing is stronger than the disease or the infection. So I'm going to touch you, and I don't have to worry about that. It's really beautiful. Yeah, Peggy.
The woman who thought, if I can just touch Jesus' robe, if I can just touch his robe, I'll be healed.
Yeah, it's a great story of faith.
And he said, I felt the power coming out of me.
Yeah. It's true, yeah, the story of a woman just having enough faith to touch Jesus' robe and believe that that would help her. It's a beautiful story. Did I see some other hands over, Dorothy? Oh, same one. It's a really beautiful one. I've always really enjoyed learning about Christian history as a way of being inspired and deepening my faith. Sometimes those stories are what you'd expect of people showing great love or bravely standing up for important principles. And that's really encouraging. But sometimes there are also stories that seem to come completely out of left field that we wouldn't expect, but that we can still find really profound new understanding of something about faith. and even something about life if we're open to God showing us even in those unexpected lessons and stories. Another example some of you may remember, because I've mentioned it in a couple sermons before, that sort of is an example of this out-of-left-field thing of Christian history, is that Thanksgiving was fought over for a really long time in United States history as a holiday. And it's because Congregationalists in the North that we connect to wanted that to happen, like that they were celebrating it, but they wanted to see the whole country celebrate it and kind of bind people together. But before the Civil War, the South really resisted celebrating Thanksgiving. They liked Christmas better, but Congregationalists thought that Christmas and Easter were sort of too fancy and ornate, and it wasn't simple enough, and so they didn't believe in celebrating those. And the Southerners resisted celebrating Thanksgiving because they thought that that was the Congregationalists being all arrogant, sort of like the parable in the Bible of the Pharisee who says, "Thank you, God, that I am not like the sinners that are, you know, beating their breasts before you and very happy about themselves." And because a lot of Congregationalists were abolitionists, the Southerners were like, "You're just being morally superior. We're not going to celebrate your stupid Thanksgiving holiday." Right? That's not one I'd never heard before I studied it. And it kind of comes out of nowhere, but there's a lot of lessons you can just hear in our understanding of thankfulness, of celebration, of what we say is holy. My favorite example, though, of something that I've learned from church history happened actually in the first few centuries of the early church. And that was when there was a lot of persecution for Christians from the Roman Empire. And I learned it in seminary, and it turns out that the primary charge that Christians were arrested and punished and persecuted for was what you might not expect. It was for impious atheism. Huh? How could it be that a group that was founded on a new revelation from God in the person of Jesus would be persecuted by ruling powers as atheists? When I learned that, I remember it just sort of screaming out in my head, there is something to that. Whatever was causing the people to call them that, there must be something that means something really important that we can understand deeper and that could help us understand our connection of God better. Because if that's what people back then were being called for, however they were practicing their faith, maybe there's something to understand there. And I do think that that is in fact the case. And so, has anyone heard that fact before? I saw a lot of kind of puzzled looks as well, kind of how I was the first time. But out of curiosity, does anyone know why it was that Christians were called atheists at the time of the early church? Yeah, Peggy.
They didn't believe in the Roman gods.
That is a big part of it, that they didn't celebrate with the Roman gods. That's true. So we have to remember that the Roman Empire included lots of different people groups and lots of different cultures. They've conquered all over the Mediterranean. And the Romans, like the Persians before them, that we read about a lot in the Old Testament, by the way, had figured out that managing all those people together works a lot better if each of those people get to keep a little bit of their identity and they're not completely wiped out. And religion can be one of those things that's especially helpful that way. So the Romans had already adopted their pantheon of gods, primarily from the Greeks, but just sort of renamed them, right? Like the Roman god of Jupiter was essentially the same as the Greek god Zeus, and so on. And so it was easy enough for them to say, all right, well, we can add in gods from these other people groups in the empire. We'll say they're all like kind of part of our shared culture together. And so, yeah, that god of yours sounds good enough. We'll add it in. Or that god of yours sounds a lot like this god of ours. So let's just all call it our god's name and move on together from there. So they could kind of mix it all together. And this also happened, by the way, to help the Romans be able to say that the emperor was also a god on earth, a special anointed one. And the Greek word, by the way, that they would use to talk about this special anointed god on earth that was their emperor sounds familiar to us. Christ. That's the word. So the emperor also has to be worshipped. Now you could worship your own gods for whatever people group you were, so long as you also included the official Roman gods of the emperor. And what was most important with this was how you were officially worshiping along with the empire. And you were also agreeing that it was right, that the empire itself was holy because of the emperor and because of its gods, that whatever it was doing was right and worthy and holy. And it was okay to call some people worthy and some people worthless, that the gods were authorizing that, were justifying that, were saying that that was okay. And this official worship and the way that you would show that you were rubber stamping the holiness of the empire would be through official state holidays, by paying taxes at the temple. And that's how you would show especially your love for their gods. And the Jewish people, I'll mention, were actually not considered atheists by the Romans, even though there's a lot of similarity, and Christianity initially came out of the Jewish religion and was considered a Jewish sect. But even though they rejected, similarly like Peggy said, they rejected all of the Roman gods and said, we won't worship you, we don't want you to put any of your idols in our temple, we got to protect that, or otherwise we're going to go crazy. The Romans recognized that Yahweh, who the Jews worshipped, was an ethnic god. They were used to that category. Like, our people have our god, that's us, don't get in the way of that. They also had a recognizable central temple where all the worship happened. They had priestly authority structure, and political and religious leaders of Judea had created a system where they would pass on tithes as taxes to the Roman occupiers. So they're like, well, you don't believe in our gods, but we kind of get who you are and what you're about, so we can kind of partner up with you so long as we get our money and you kind of give lip service. Christians, though, were really confusing to the Romans, and then they were called atheists, because they didn't have any of that. They were specifically choosing not to acknowledge or participate in any of the ways of empire. They didn't want to use faith to prop itself up and call injustice holy. So Jewish worship, they had the whole way of working together with all the Roman occupiers. And so Romans like, you don't celebrate or worship Jupiter, all right. But Christians were now stepping completely away from that. No temple system, no priests and Pharisees and teachers of the law to bribe, nobody to say the Romans are basically okay so long as we don't bother them. Christians were rejecting all of that. They didn't acknowledge other gods. They didn't do fancy official worship or have important authority figures to bribe. They gathered in homes and had fairly shared leadership. They didn't have much to give in temple taxes because they had entered in the practice of holding their possessions in common. And they were giving most of their stuff to the poor. And worst of all, they rejected the idea that the emperor was a god. And they even used his title, Christ, to refer to someone else. A man whose glory was proven by sacrificial love. Not by conquering, not by killing people as a show of strength, like the emperor did. For the Romans, that was not faith. Those are atheists. And so maybe they are even having a revolution against our very efficient system of religion and the empire, working together to prop each other up to feel powerful, to feel holy, to feel justified in mistreating anyone who doesn't follow exactly our way. In this way, Jesus' words in our Matthew verses today are showing Jesus to be a kind of true atheist, of the God that the Pharisees and important religious people were worshiping. Jesus is saying to the people, I do not worship or even recognize the God that you've made for yourselves. This God that tells you that you can call some people more important and worthy than others, and allows those people to tell others all the hoops that they have to jump through so that God will love them. If I'm a Pharisee, I'm all set. I say I'm connected to God. I get to do whatever I want, but you have to do all the things that I won't do in order for God to accept you. Jesus said, that's not a God that I'm going to believe in. I'm an atheist to that type of God. You've gone astray from God's love, Pharisees, if that's how you're acting. And you've gone astray from that God of love and transformation that's the one that I know, that I worship, and even that I embody. Jesus' words in these verses are hard to hear, especially if we're willing to acknowledge, and it is true, that they could end up applying really to any of us. We start to value the wrong things in order to feel worthy in our own faith. But it was important to Jesus to point out that claiming God for ourselves is not exactly the same thing as being faithful, especially if we're trying to use that hold on God-like authority over other people so that we can claim ourselves as superior, claim ourselves as the owners of God who is over all of us. So, Jesus' words are reminding us that if we get to that place where we want to say, I'm in control of God, and I get to control you because of that, not that we are all under God's control together, and we worship that God of love and transformation, that we're going to have to make our way back to the true God that Jesus lifts up and that Jesus, in fact, is. And what might surprise us is that when we make our way back, we will probably find God, like we found Jesus, with some kind of surprising people that a lot of other folks, like the important Pharisees and religious officials, like the Roman officials, might say, that person's dirty. That person's unworthy. That person's horrible. You aren't supposed to be with them. But that's where we tended to find Jesus throughout the Gospels. We should also know that many of the Jewish people in Jesus' time had a way of interacting with the people in other cultures who had different religious backgrounds. And it was very different than the Romans, sort of absorbing it and not thinking about it very much. They had a name for people that they found common values and common cause with. And this is a word you'll see in the Gospels. It was God-fearers. These were people who were not Jewish, had not fully converted to Judaism with things like circumcision, with things like meeting the full expectations of temple cleanliness, but they were people who acknowledged the worthiness and glory of Yahweh, who lived in peace and cooperation with Jews, and who lived the justice and love of the law that God had given at its best. This name was given to many of the Gentiles that Jesus interacted with throughout the Gospels and who he helped with miracles or healings or other things like that, including some of the stories that were lifted up before. Those would be considered God-fearers because not all of them were Jews when they came. And our Genesis verses about Melchizedek give perhaps the prime example of a God-fearer and how God brings blessing to the established faithful, in this case Abram, and God-fearers together. Melchizedek would be a God-fearer. When they moved in common purpose. This passage comes after Abram had rescued his nephew Lot and stood up to kings in the area of the ancient Near East that they were living that had broken a peace between people groups and were killing and enslaving their neighboring people. The story acknowledges God's special work with Abram, but in introducing Melchizedek and making him, in fact, in the story, the authority of faith, the story also shows Abram is not in control by himself of God. Abram, in fact, has his faith expanded by this outsider. Melchizedek, we have not met before. We don't know how God has been interacting with other people besides Abram up to that point. We had the story of Noah. We had the story of Babel. We had the story of Adam and Eve and their kids in the Bible. But this is still really early. And Melchizedek introduces, in fact, this title for God that has not been in the Bible up to this point. It's the first time it happens. God Most High. And is saying, essentially the Bible is saying, this name that comes from this outsider, this other people group, this other nation, is referring to our same God, is an expansion of the understanding of who Yahweh is for Abram. Because Abram would have likely thought, well, like all the people around me, I have my family God, Yahweh. Yahweh spoke to me. He said he's going to bless my family's going to grow. That's my God. And I know that there's all these other cities and all these other people who have their gods. And they're just kind of like all in competition with each other, and hopefully mine wins. But to say that there's a God Most High, that Yahweh is God Most High, takes God out of that conception of just we have our private deities that work just for us, and says, nope, God is above all of that, for everyone. You don't get to control God, and God is powerful enough to connect the whole world and to be sovereign over the whole world and have everyone worship that way. That's the first time that that would have come to Abram's conception, and it comes from this outsider that God puts in Abram's path, and it's an amazing lesson. And this all becomes even more meaningful when we remember that in the book of Hebrews, Jesus is called a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Essentially what that means is Jesus is a priest for everyone, not in control of the presumed faithful authorities, and therefore, Jesus brings belonging to all people, including Gentiles. This is what the early church that was called atheists was doing as they were coming together, by the way. They were not setting up a new power system of faith to shove outsiders into shame for not fitting in exactly. They were looking for God-fearers of all types and building healing, transforming community together under God's guidance. That's how they were able to bring together Jews, Gentiles, people from all over the known world. They were expecting that they would all learn and grow together. And that's what we see throughout like the letters of Paul, that sometimes the Jews are being told, you're not getting it quite right. You got to listen to God and change things up. Sometimes the Gentiles are being told, you're not getting it quite right. You need to listen to the other believers and figure that out together. In Acts 10, God uses an encounter with a Roman official to show Peter how Jesus' kingdom was for everyone, not just the Jews. In Acts 17, Paul honors Greek seekers in the Areopagus. They're kind of like common square for philosophers, by saying how they're altered to an unknown God, and the most loving and just words from some of their prophets were pointing them to God. Their prophets and poets are quoted in the Bible. In passages like Acts 16 and 19, we see that some people, or some of the times that did the worst persecution to Paul and his companions, was when they were helping people of different cultural faiths, but who were seeking a life of the values of Jesus' kingdom. And they were trying to get rid of and free from the control of rich, powerful, Roman, and, by the way, Jewish authorities who were trying to make money off of them. The formation of Christianity was not about rejecting and condemning religious outsiders who were looking to be a part of God's loving, just, and transforming way of life. It was about rejecting and condemning a certain type of religion that was about people saying that they had God's authority to dehumanize others, to exclude others, and to make themselves great. So the atheism that the Christians were accused of has always been about claiming a different kind of Christ than the people who want religion to be just about dominating other people, like Christ the Emperor. This atheism is about not holding ourselves over people who are outsiders and not holding them to the subject of the whims of some religious power system. Do we believe in and ally ourselves with God, the God who transforms each of us, who transforms the world through grace and love and justice by walking closely with us even when we are broken? And does that God, do we worship him and follow him to help us connect with others who are experiencing the same? Or do we try to use religion and try to use our faith just as a way to claim power and advantage for ourselves? Do we try to look holy by calling other people unworthy? Do we fawn over people who prop themselves up this way and claim leadership despite the fact that they're acting more like Caesar than they are like Jesus? Understanding this history of Christian atheism is why I love the song Unbelievers so much. It's why I find it so worshipful. Why, for me, this feels like a song of conversation between Jesus and I, like Jesus is acting in Matthew 23. Why I do want to try to be an unbeliever and an atheist to the God of the Pharisees, God of the powerful oppressors, the God who kept out people groups, and the God who propped up the Roman Empire. But I have to admit that it is often tempting to worship that type of faith more, to want that sense of control for myself, that sense of superiority, that sense of having an enemy to eliminate instead of an enemy to love. Like the song says, I want to be born again. I want to be a person of grace and light and warmth and soul. I want to have that from God so that I can join God in sharing that with others who know that they need it too. And especially when the world is cold and dark and says and acts like God's values are of no value. I want to be with God, even and especially if that means disbelieving in the way that some people set up religious systems, to keep all of that life and grace and light and warmth and soul from the wrong kinds of people. I want Jesus' help and I want Jesus' transformation so that my faith will be fully after the real Jesus, not my own construction of him that suits me and not other people. And so I hope to be a God-fearer like Melchizedek, or like Good Samaritans, or the Jews and Gentiles of the early church who stepped away from those religious power systems and created a new type of community of love and justice, of transformation that nobody else knew what to do with, and that even ended up costing them dearly when those powerful religious people felt threatened and would charge them as atheists and arrest them and sometimes even kill them. I want us to notice in the song as we wrap up, especially these contrasting metaphors of faith and religion as being like a train on the tracks versus a faith that's like being caught up in the sea. Faith on the tracks makes us feel like we're in control of God. We can steer things exactly the way that we want. and we're able to barrel over whoever we wish. The ocean, though, acknowledges that God is vast, covers all directions, is beyond our control. So we have to be attuned to the way that God leads, with seasons of calm and tumultuousness both. And it shows that we all need God. We can't control God. Not only with that controlling, but think about the ways that these metaphors encourage us to connect with other people. With a train, you're either on the train or you're getting run over by it. Maybe at best you're off to the side and you want to join up, but you have to, like, if the train's going, you got to run, hopefully just scramble on the back and grab on and be dragged along, and maybe someone will help you up, maybe not. If you want to really extend the metaphor and get like train stations, that still means that anybody who doesn't live right close to a train station, they have to go out of their way to get themselves to the station before they can even get on the train to go where the train is going. Similarly, once you're on the train, most people just sit around. The engineer does a lot of stuff, but everyone else is just kind of sitting there enjoying the view. On the ocean, you go looking for people that are overboard. You have life preservers and lifeboats that help people to come on board. And then when people are on a boat, they share, and you need lots of people with lots of roles, all helping to make things work. And everyone is going to share in the rolling of the sea, the blowing of the wind. You can't force your way out of that and just sit there. So we want to be about warmth and grace and light and love, not about running people down. We can do our best to cooperate together and ride the waves of God moving in our world as we do so. It may be that some people see that as disbelieving in what they prefer, and they may even see it as a threat to what makes them feel powerful. Maybe they'll want to throw us down, run us down, and throw us in a fire. But I feel pretty confident there's more than enough drops of holy water in the oceans of God's love and truth to put out the engine fire of any train that's going off on its own track and would try to put us off our own voyage with Jesus. And I look forward to hopefully going on that voyage together with you in the coming days, weeks, months, and years. Let's continue in worship, offering ourselves to the ocean of God's love with our offering.